Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's Alchemy of Light broadcast. I am so grateful to be welcoming you to this very special broadcast on the new moon, beginning the fifth lunation. And we are graduating the Alchemy of Light broadcast. We are welcoming today our very first exploration and celebration of consciousness with David Lawns, a musician. Musicians have arrived, good people. Welcome, David.
There's no party unless there's music.
Ah, and how? And how? Well, for those of you who may not be familiar with David Lawns, he is a Grammy-nominated pianist and composer, indeed a lifelong an accomplished musician from childhood. This is his calling and this is his gift, and he has blessed the world with so many albums and so many recordings and so many inspirational notes that are there in the ether for all. And so he is a fantastic person to begin the conversation of consciousness in music with. And what an honor to. And so please, in your own words, would you introduce yourself to the audience?
Well, first, you know, thanks for having me on. It's great to, it's great to, you know, start your show off with the an actual musical person like myself. My name's David Lawns, and I am chatting with you from the northwest of the United States, up in the little corner of the northwest in Bellingham, Washington, not too far from Seattle, where I was born. And yes, I have been at this business of music since about the age of 4 and a half, when I guess I was driving my mom nuts. I kept getting on the piano and saying, "Hey, Mom, what's this? What note's this? What note's this?" I always heard her play. She played her own kind of style of music, and, you know, kind of some church hymns. But then once in a while, she'd break out and play some boogie woogie, and that's what got me excited as a little guy. So I figured when I went to the piano teacher that's what I was going to learn how to play. But unfortunately, it didn't start with boogie woogie. I had to work my way up to that, and I had to, you know, study some more, you know, more classical stuff. And but really, by the time I was 10, I was writing my own music. I shouldn't say write. I was actually composing. Writing is a whole different thing altogether. But I was making things up, and by the time I was 12, I basically fired my piano teacher and said, "Okay, I'm on my own." And a year later, I had my first little rock band. And a year after that, the Beatles became a worldwide phenomenon. And I've been rocking and rolling and ever since. So, you know, that's kind of where it all started for me.
That's fantastic. And to have timed it just so, when there would be a music revolution at exactly the time you were ready to take your own. That was good timing there, David.
Well, I mean, there's a whole generation of musicians that really, you know, tipped their hat to Lennon, McCartney, and well, just the whole, you know, the whole phenomenon that was the Beatles, because they not only changed the whole world of music, and really, they changed the world. But they laid down the gauntlet and said, "Okay, just because you're a musician doesn't mean you can't write your own music as well." Because up to that time, you know, we had in popular music, you know, going back to, you know, artists like Frank Sinatra and all the way up to Elvis Presley, most of those artists never wrote their own material. It never really occurred to them, because there were songwriters that did that. And here come the Beatles, you know, they were performing their own music. They were actually writing a lot of music for other artists at the same time. So it was a really unique happening. And like I said, many musicians, especially from my era, were very inspired by this. So we all started to grow our hair out and write our own songs and, you know, try our luck at, you know, imitating the Fab Four. And so yeah, that was It was a great era, the 60s and the 70s. There was just an explosion, starting with the Beatles, and then you had the whole British invasion, which, of course, we still have the Rolling Stones around, and there were just umpteen groups that came out of England in that time period. And then that led into folk rock with, like, the Byrds, and then the psychedelic era, which the Beatles kind of led the charge there with Sgt. Pepper. And, of course, then we had Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and the Doors and Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell, and Santana and Led Zeppelin. And it was just this whole, gestalt of musicians that pretty much set the tone for those two decades. And if you listen to the radio now, you'll still hear their influence. It's most of the music that we hear today is very much, very derivative, at least in part, from what happened in the 60s and the 70s.
That's really fascinating. I really appreciate learning that, because you're just enough ahead of me that the Beatles, by the time I was conscious of popular music, they had made their big splash. But I, to be honest, was never a fan of the Beatles' music. I didn't know any of the backstory from the musician's conscious perspective that you just shared. So that's really fantastic to learn. But for me personally, the Beatles were very influential just the same. I know people who, had to have every, disc and listen to it. But I was profoundly impacted by the music of the Beatles peripherally, by the messages in the song and in various songs of theirs. And I mean, we're still imagining that world, right, where we live as one. And in my teens, they were marked with the assassination of John Lennon. And that was, of course, very formative as well in my own consciousness of being your own person and what does that mean, and expressing yourself, and the chances, the risk you run in taking that and making that your doctrine, making that your position, making that who you are in the world. So for me, I could not be affected. But to be honest, the compilation that I am really grateful to have received, the second part of your most current work, is a 2-CD compilation that you call the Reimagining of the Beatles. And the second disc is Here Comes the Sun. And frankly, this is the first time I have really enjoyed the Beatles music for the music of it. What you did to this music was allowed me to appreciate more the nuance of it. Their music for me was always a little loud. They just didn't do it for me musically. So I think that's really interesting to hear how not only were they such an important statement to all musicians. I mean, the idea that you didn't play your own music, that actually never occurred to me till you just said that.
That's just how it was. We had back there were, jazz musicians, who some of which were writing their own music, but even the jazz musicians of the 40s and the 50s were playing pop songs, and then they would just, they would jazz them up. They'd all play solos over popular tunes, and that's still a popular way for many jazz musicians. They'll still play. They're called standards. They call it the real book, and they pull out, an old song that someone wrote in the 30s or 40s, maybe a Gershwin song, and then they just have their way with it. But yeah, it was a really unusual when the Beatles showed up and were writing their own songs, and it really just changed the whole landscape. And then, as you pointed out, each of the Beatles were, besides the band, they kind of started to outgrow the whole Beatle phenomenon, because they were conflicted, and there were a lot of problems within the group, and it started to hold them back musically a bit. So they all kind of broke out on their own, and every one of them has had very successful solo careers. They continued in their own rights to, push the cultural limits forward. And, we all probably, most people probably know the story of John and Yoko and how they campaigned for world peace. And John wrote all kinds of great music after the Beatles. You mentioned the song Imagine. That's kind of that's one of the top thematic pieces of consciousness from pop music of all time. And what's interesting about George Harrison that many people don't know, because of George Harrison, we in the Western world discovered meditation and yoga, and those things had never been they'd been very much underground. I remember when I was just a teenager, I was reading in one of my, it was like Teen Beat magazine, one of these teenage magazines, and had pictures of the Beatles, and they had gone to India, and they met Maharishi, who was the founder of this transcendental meditation movement, and which was starting to take off a little bit, and it was actually George Harrison's wife told George, well, we got to go listen to this guy talk. So he was very much taken by what Maharishi was doing. The Beatles, they brought some of their friends like Donovan and some of the guys from the Beach Boys, Mia Farrow and such, and they all went to India. And this whole phenomenon of starting to discover what the East had to offer, not only with the meditation, but then George met Ravi Shankar, who is one of the greatest sitar masters of all time. And I don't think anyone that I knew even knew what a sitar was. So George kind of single-handedly, because of his pop status, introduced America, at least my generation, to what we now call world music. And then beyond that, George was turned on to a man by name of Paramahansa Yogananda. You may have read his classic book, Autobiography of a Yogi. If you haven't, you really should sit down and read that. That is an amazing book. But George was really taken with Paramahansa and his message, and he introduced the Beatles to that. And I just actually recently found that out. I read a really great book called Everyday Mystic. It just talks about George's whole spiritual odyssey, which began in the 60s, kind of, in a psychedelic era, and eventually kind of set the tone for his life. And he was always called the quiet Beatle, but he just, he tended to be a little bit more introspective. And he had a real, his spirit was really egging him on to, make a difference, in a positive sense with the music that he played.
That's really interesting, and it's really it's also really important to have this conversation and review the human side of the Beatles. In the pop time when the stars, quote, the celebrities are making their splash and all, I find especially in the American culture that is so materialist, and really we're subliminally programmed that's making it right. When you're the big star, then you of course have lots and lots of money and you're it, right? And they don't tell you about all the managers and all the hardship, and they don't tell you about the drug industry. They don't tell you about all that. But the truth is that most people take time to visit history, don't take time to really visit the reality of the people. There's actually a person named George that was part of this, that had this very specific journey that he very specifically was able to share and seed here. And that's really, really important, I think, to visit and to honor him for. I appreciate that a lot, because how much have we grown now? It's fascinating to me how we can see in the last two decades how much we have grown, and talking to you again, just giving gratitude for those who have come before, it never fails to amaze me how important that is, really. So tell me a little more of your stories of the Beatles as people. You have some great information that I would love to share with the listeners.
Well, you know, I had the advantage of you know, meeting the Beatles. I mean, I was barely 13. In fact, I think at the time when they first appeared on American television, which you can tell I'm a fanatic. It was February the 9th, 1964. It was on the Ed Sullivan Show there in New York City. And some of the guys were still teenagers. I mean, they were very young. I think the oldest guy was John. I think he was 21 or 22. So they were very, very young. And it was all very exciting for them for the first couple of years. But it got old really quick for them because they were out touring the world. And this goes back so far that as far as most musicians will realize what it's like to be on stage, and you've got these monitor speakers so you can actually hear what's going on, because the main speakers are aimed out at the audience, you know, when you're singing, and if any of the microphones are on the instruments, the only way you're going to hear anything is by having these monitors. Well, here come the Beatles. The monitors weren't invented yet, as far as I know, and they were on stage, and there was thousands and thousands of screaming teenagers. They couldn't hear anything. They could just, you know, they'd count off a song, and they'd hear the first couple chords, and then that was it. They literally only had a 20-minute set, and that's what they played on stage for the first couple of years. Everywhere, every time they hit a stage all over the world, they had 20 minutes of music, a lot of hits in there, and they never really heard anything, so they weren't growing as a band. Up to that point, they had been playing in nightclubs. They played famously in the Star Club in Hamburg, Germany, for a number of years, where they'd play 6, 7, 8 hours a night. And that's how they really got their act together, by playing, hour after hour and jamming and working on new songs. So here they are in the middle of Beatlemania. And so the first few years were very frustrating, and it was a lot of fun because they were meeting a lot of other famous people, and they were young, and so all the partying and all the accoutrements of being famous were appealing at first. But then the stress and the late nights and the touring and the one hotel after another hotel after one interview after another interview, it got very old for them, and they withdrew, and at one point George Harrison quit the band a couple of times in the middle of this, and just because of the stress. You know, that's the other thing about being, you know, quote unquote famous, the stress of always having to be on. And no matter where you go, someone sees you, and they expect you to be this, you know, shining star. Well, you might have woken up and maybe you're not feeling that good, you know, and you don't want to sign an autograph, or you don't want to talk to someone about something that at the moment isn't that important to you. But the fans, you know, expect a certain amount of energy from a, you know, celebrity when they meet them. So they kind of withdrew, but because of all the stress that they went through during the Beatlemania phase, really helped them focus as individuals in the recording studio. And that's where things really started to get interesting. Initially you had three of the guys, you know, John, Paul, and George were all writing songs, but they started to discover the recording studio in terms of the things that you could do, different effects that you could get, and the way you could alter the music and create this audio world. So besides totally transforming the way we think about live music, they went in the studio and they completely changed the way we think about recorded music, which culminated in a bunch of brilliant recordings ending up, well, I think, you know, most people would agree that right at the point of doing their Sgt. Pepper recording, they made an album that was so beyond anything that had ever been heard before. I know other pop musicians, I've read interviews like with David Crosby from, you know, the Birds and Crosby, Stills and Nash, and he just sat in the studio and listened to Sergeant Pepper, I think he was a friend of George's or something, and basically said, okay, well, it's over. You know, what can we do now? I mean, you guys have done it all. So there was just a lot of exploration. And so in a way, their fame allowed them to take the time to, you know, because it took a lot of time and a lot of experimentation in the studio to go where they wanted to go. But they all basically were you know, geniuses, musical geniuses. And they were on a mission, and they were looking for sounds that had not been heard before. Nowadays, you know, some of the music might sound passé, only because you know we've heard it all. But thanks to them and you know their producer George Martin, there's just this very rich musical legacy that they've left behind, and they've inspired so many people. It's just amazing, you know. I mean, you'd probably be hard pressed to find many interviews of you know recording artists that don't at some point at least point to the Beatles in terms of some sort of an influence that they've had in their lives.
Actually, I can agree with that. I certainly have many musicians, and I can agree with that. Though musically it's, you know, always been peripheral for me, I do have been inspired and influenced by them. So it's really interesting in the conversation of consciousness how so much more is going on than meets the eye. You know, here are these four guys who are cruising around, you know, and do you think that they had any idea that they were going to completely really change the whole entire landscape of music and art in their lifetime, you know?
Yeah.
And the ripple effects in all of our consciousness continue to play out and develop and mature in their different ways. And it's really interesting how they also have made it they've given, it sounds by your sharing that, they give all of us permission to, you know, sing our own songs, you know? That is something that, how could we overlook that in a way, you know? So I would like to ask you about the compilation that you did now that I understand the depth of your love for them. Then you brought that to your compilation. And so perhaps maybe you could share with us a little bit about this recent undertaking for you. And we can share a song, post that with the people.
Yeah, the creating, just so you know, I mean, up until, well, I would say probably my first, you know, 10 or maybe, you know, 15 albums, it was all music that I had written, for my, you know, for the piano, and I'm a composer, but it was, in the process of touring and meeting younger musicians, I started to do a number of piano workshops, and people were always interested in what my influences were, so as a way to really started to really put my kind of money where my mouth was, I decided that it was time for me to pay tribute to the songwriting of Lennon, McCartney, and now on Sir George Harrison as well. Because as a young musician, you know, people always want to know where I studied composition. Well, I never studied composition. You know, I learned by the joy of imitating my idols, which for the most part were just listening endlessly to you know, the music of the Beatles for starts, and there was a lot of other artists that came along later. But and even to this day, when I'm composing a piece of music, there's always some little thing that I learned from listening to a certain song of theirs, and you know, in terms of a chord progression or you know, transposing into a different key, or how they, you know, well, how would Paul do this? You know, so all their impact on me as a composer has just worked its well has worked its way into my DNA. So it's really just, I don't really feel any. It's almost like I'm in the band, you know. So the process of coming up, first of all, I had to decide which songs, because they wrote so many great songs. And part of the process for me was finding out which songs, you know, I had the most resonance with. And usually they weren't the biggest hits. I think a lot of people, and I think probably maybe yourself, there's probably certain songs that you heard on the radio of the Beatles, and they got played so often you get tired of them. I think that's true with any artist. And it happened with them, because their music, people would pick certain songs and the big hits, and they get played over and over again. I was usually attracted to a lot of the music that wasn't as well known. You would know the music if you had their albums, but a lot of people didn't have all the albums. They just, you know, they just heard what they heard on the radio. So I went through initially with Liverpool, and I picked songs. I picked a song called "Things We Said Today," which was not a big hit, but it had kind of this minor motif. It was a little, for them, it wasn't as poppy and happy-go-lucky. And songs like "Yes It Is," which is a beautiful love ballad by John Lennon. Again, not a big hit. So I guess I kind of skewed to the mellower stuff at first of the Beatles. Especially on the first album. And then when it came time to do another record, I just kept going and I kept picking my favorites. But one of the songs that people always requested when I first was out, you know, playing the music off of Liverpool, people said, "Well, do you do Here Comes the Sun?" And I went, "No, I haven't, you know, I love that song, but I've never worked it up." And that was one, in a way, I was kind of avoiding that song only because it was such a huge hit. As it turns out, Here Comes the Sun is the most downloaded Beatles song ever.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah. So that, like I say on stage, I say, I bet George is smiling from heaven knowing he finally bested John and Paul, because they kind of, They'd always would give, George was the youngest guy in the group, so they started giving him one song per record. But he was writing a lot of music, and he really was not getting his, he didn't feel like he was getting his fair share of airtime on the albums at first. So, so now here it is, the most downloaded song is his. So, I started listening to other people. And people were making requests, and why don't you do this song and this song, and so I took all this under consideration, but for me it really came down to picking songs not only that I liked, but ones that laid well on the keyboard, because I'm not singing, and you know, these are instrumental arrangements, so I wanted it to be able to perform a piece and have it kind of lay right on the keyboard and, you know, make it so I could make it my own. And when I sat with Here Comes the Sun, it just immediately came together, and it was like, whoa, well, that was easy. I should have picked that one a long time ago. So this might be a good segue to play the piece. I don't know if you still want to play Here Comes the Sun, but this might make a good place to try to slip that into the show.
Sure. That is such a lovely piece. Okay, so we are going to play track number 2, Here Comes the Sun. I'm giving that to my help there in the back.
This also features Gary Straustus on flute, who I know is going to be a guest of yours in a month or so, and my buddy Walter Gray, who's an amazing cellist, part of the Seattle Symphony here in the Northwest. And then Keith Lowe, who plays the bass. So that's the whole group. And you'll probably know who the piano player is. You've been talking to him.
Yes, I'm very, very excited about bringing him. He is also another very soulful musician and a flutist, and did some very nice work on Here Comes the Sun. And his whole mission, I'm very inspired by his mission and his work with the indigenous people and the love of the flute. He kind of reminds me a bit of you. He's perhaps part flute by now. His DNA has merged with the flute.
Oh, yeah.
So as soon as my guy here comes along, we will go ahead and offer that.
Okay, great.
And
'60s and the '70s played in a lot of different, you know, rock and roll bands, and I played jazz and country music and blues, and I found myself, you know, in the studio working behind other singer-songwriters and writing music for jingles, and I did some music for some small local filmmakers, and so I really tried everything out. But then somewhere in the mid '70s, I started to really explore meditation and started wondering about how music could be part of you know, introspection and meditation. And actually, I began with, I guess I was doing yoga in the mid '70s, and it might have been the early '80s. Sometimes I forget exactly when, but someone gave me a tape. I think it was called the Spectrum Suite. And later on, I met this man. He's become kind of a friend of mine. I've run into him a few places. His name's Stephen Halperin. Stephen Halperin has been called the father, I think, of New Age music. You know, whether or not you agree with that, he was one of the first people to. He was doing the same thing. He was exploring the use of sound, and I found I was using his tape, the Spectrum Suite, which basically went through all seven chakras. And he was just kind of floating around on an electric piano. He created this really nice ambient feeling and this real floaty kind of feeling. So I really enjoyed that. It worked really great for yoga and for, you know, for relaxing and kind of contemplation after the yoga. But it really got me to thinking about, well, now, how do I take, you know, this kind of inner feeling, and I'm listening to Stephen and what he was doing. And I said, well, how do I take that and create that same kind of nice ambient, that nice, you know, experience, only turn it more into, you know, into a musical form that might be a little more ready for prime time, something that you could play for someone that maybe they didn't want to meditate, but they wanted to listen to, you know, music that's kind of had that same kind of feeling. And I started to experiment with, because at the time I was writing a lot, I've written lots and lots of what you would call pop songs. And so I said, well, how do I take, you know, this attitude, this shift in, you know, the way I'm looking at music and the application of it, and make it accessible to the average person. So I kind of coined the term Zen pop, and I started experimenting and writing kind of, you know, a song that, you know, that had an introduction and a verse and a bridge and, you know, a kind of a basic structure of a pop song, only it was played through this filter of, you know, creating something that maybe had a little more of a healing or, you know, it created a relaxation response. And that's kind of where I started. You know, like I would guess in the late 70s and the early 80s, I really kind of started to explore that side, taking the, you know, the feelings and the thoughts that I had gained from my own introspective reading of, you know, reading a lot, like I said, Paramahansa Yogananda, and then different masters, Jesus, Saint Germain and Buddha and such, reading and experiencing, you know, that world, and then taking the world of music that I knew very well and blending the two. And then at one point I kind of asked myself the question, what does the world need from me? You know, I mean, what can I contribute? And the answer did not come back, you know, a big pop hit. I mean, that's what I'd been working my whole life. I wanted to, you know, write this big, exciting pop song that would be, you know, I hear it on the radio. And well, I kind of ended up getting all of those things kind of came to fruition for me, but it came via this different style of music that was coined New Age. Some people like that term, and it's not a musical term, so it created a little confusion in some of the people that listen to the music that I do. But that's fine, you know. I mean, I ended up having as far as Billboard magazine, which is kind of the industry standard for keeping track of the charts and who's buying records. The very first number one New Age album on the chart was my album Christofori's Dream. So that's kind of where my consciousness and all the work that I had done kind of exploded, and when it hit the mainstream, and then kind of the rest is history, as they say, you know. And that album pretty much changed my life, and, you know, sold hundreds and hundreds of thousands of copies, and I think it's almost platinum by now. But so that was a you know, that kind of fills in the gap between my, you know, the Beatles and the rock and roll era up to the present day, you know. And then again, the Beatles stuff, again, I'm, like I said, I was just looking back and I was paying tribute to my mentors. And in a way, just I'm doing that because I meet so many, there's so many young musicians that I'm meeting, just great. I've had these YouTube contests and all these, you know, these teenage kids are entering and they're writing their own songs. And I just thought it was important for me to let them know that, they say, well, you're a, they tell me that I'm a big influence on them. So I'm saying, that's great. So these are the people that have been an influence on me, you know? And then if they're interested, they can, they do some research on the Beatles and they'd find out that they were very much influenced by skiffle music and big band music and the music of American, you know, black musicians like, you know, Muddy Waters and you know, and so it goes. So I think it's, no matter where we are kind of in the chain, it's always good to not only have a vision forward, but to look back at where you've been and, you know, all of that information kind of keeps you grounded, I think, in the moment.
Hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's how we create the world we want to live in. Yeah.
Yes, I think so. I think, you know, by looking back, we can find the best of the things that we want to continue and carry forward. And hopefully we can look back and we can see the mistakes and hopefully recreate a future that, you know, from learning from those mistakes, so we can carry on without the, you know, without the darkness that was in the past, you know, and just shine a light on it and transform it and get on with your life, you know, and power to the people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think also an important step that you shared in your process a bit is when we're looking at things and the things that were, for example, in your sharing of, okay, I'm trying to make the pop music. And then you ask the question, well, what does the world need? In your surrender to the true answer, you were led, you were allowed to go ahead and Cristofori's dream was born, which was a change from your head thinking or the motivation to that point. And it allowed, but that motivation to that point was what got you all of those influences, that gave you all of that inspiration and all that fascinating juice for what inevitably became, you know, Cristofori's dream and the birth of this whole new genre. I personally would, in the music of instrumental melodious music that's not classical, is I think of you as one of the people that I consider the leaders of that. You, from in my consciousness, birthed that for me. You were, Cristofori's dream was one of the first instrumental piano pieces that was not classically based that I really resonated with and was very interested in and very comforted by. And I was always a classical music lover, but that was my break. Your music was actually my break from, oh, there's more to instrumental music than classical. So that, so to me, the new age, cool, it was confusing. And so I just kind of abandoned that. I just went to the other one.
Yeah, the term new age really was, well, it's kind of a lifestyle term, but it was really picked by people that were marketing this music in the mainstream. The major record labels got together and they, mm-hmm, were looking, there were a lot of different labels for this music. It was called new acoustic or ambient. Some of the synthesizer music was called space music or meditation music. But we just, if you look at your musical history, the era of music that preceded New Age music was called New Wave. And that, of course, was the music like the Police and the Cars. And there were a lot of, you know, the Talking Heads. And so that term New Wave had just kind of left, had kind of become passé. And when they saw the term New Age on the list, that just, I think they probably thought that was the logical progression of pop music or something. So that was the term that they picked, and they didn't really realize all of the, maybe the, you know, the spiritual ramifications and lifestyle ramifications that kind of get caught up in the term New Age. And like I said, it's not really a musical term, so it did create a little confusion in people. So I guess they felt like they had to be like into Shirley MacLaine and crystals and UFOs or something to like this kind of music. Mm. And that's all good, but I mean, it's just, music should, you know, it doesn't really need to be put into a box. And but that's the way we do it in America, you know, the way we market it. You know, we have got to put it in a box, put a bow on it, and then people are feel like they can imbibe. So the other thing I wanted to let people know, like I've been talking about workshops and working with younger kids, and you know, I was trained to read music. I don't really use that so much anymore because I'm making up my own music now, and I don't need to write it down. I can record it. And but thanks to Hal Leonard, they've got, I think, 19 books out now of my music. So if people are interested out there that want to play any of the music of mine, it's in these books, you know, so they can, it's been amazing. I didn't set out to publish music. I just wanted to, you know, my biggest goal was really just to hear myself on the radio. And I've gone beyond that, and I think they've sold almost 250,000 of these books so far. So that's been amazing to meet all these, just knowing that there's piano students all over the world now that can sit down and just, they don't have to play the radio. They can just sit down at the piano and play any of these songs that I've come up with.
That's really, please tell us where people can find you and find out more information and tell us any more events and good news that is coming up.
Well, basically, you know, my whole world is pretty much available at davidlawns.com. And my last name is spelled LANZ, like zebra. So davidlawns.com, and on there I've got a little online store where people can find, you know, all the recordings and all the books. And I've got a number of DVDs. I've even got it set up to where if you're a piano player and you're just looking for one song, you can, for just a few dollars, you can download the sheet music for one piece. And and all my concert events are listed on there as well. There's always, you know, new stuff happening. Of course, Facebook is happening. There's a lot of new posts on Facebook, and I'm a Twitter person. And so I have the social media stuff. I'm kind of plugged into all that. People can always send me an email message via the site, and all that stuff goes right to me. So I'm pretty accessible. I also do a little bit of coaching if people want to do some musical coaching. I've had a number of professional pianists contact me with that program. And I've also worked with young students. So I just enjoy sharing, sharing what I have with anyone that's interested. So davidlawns.com, it's all there.
Yay, David. All right. Well, I understand you're getting ready for a big show tonight, so we want to be sure to respect our time and let you go on time. So we've got just about 5 minutes left, and then after we finish, we'll go ahead and go out with that song that we started before and let you go with
great.
That. Yeah. Okay. So please, offer please to all of us, you know, one thing about the artist's consciousness, the idea of living close to the work of your soul. We have a phenomenal time happening on our planet right now. And one thing that a lot of people are now finding is their worlds are not working according to the old dictates, and they have a lot of time, and they have, I hear constantly a lot of questions about, well, who am I? You know, what is my soul? And somebody in your position, I feel like, has a tremendous wealth to offer that question. Not that you can tell people who they are, because only we can find that out for ourselves, but in the conversation of how do you, if there's one thing or two things that you might recommend to somebody who's sitting on the edge and wondering, what is their life purpose? How can I be like David and find my muse, you know? What would you say to that person?
Well, I think the simplest thing for people to do is to set more time aside to be introspective. I would really guarantee people, I would recommend to folks to learn how to meditate, you know, and it doesn't have to be anything, you know, you don't have to sit in a lotus position and go off into a cave for 30 years anymore. There's lots and lots of books and information on the internet to get you started in that. And basically all meditation is, it's a way to kind of quiet your mind. I think if you're familiar with, you know, prayer, you know, you can incorporate prayer with your meditation. If you've got a lot of life challenges ahead, you know, the answers usually come if we're quiet and we ask a question and we have to really listen, the answer will usually come right away. It's usually whispered. It takes many of us, sometimes our whole lives, to hear that voice, but that voice is there. And it's just a matter of cultivating that relationship with what I would call really your higher self, or your soul, or people, you know, we have a lot of different names for it. But there is this kind of guiding principle to kind of what I would call the I am presence that we can all really tap into. And it really just takes a moment to do it. It's just, but you have to be conscious to do it. There are events that occasionally will, you know, accidents and things that will force people to look at who they are in their lives and what they've been doing. You know, you have all these stories of near-death experiences and such. That's one way to do it. It's a rough way to go. So, short of having some sort of, you know, having the universe really kick you up alongside the head, if you can just, you know, find the time to you know, like I say, either begin meditation or some spiritual practice. It can be based on, you know, maybe the religion you were brought up in appeals to you, or maybe that's another one of the institutions that is crumbling around you, and you know you're not feeling the love or the security there. I think the greatest teacher you've got is your heart, and meditation really will help you, you know, lead you into your own heart, and from there, really all answers are accessible. Of course, you know, you need patience and you know, we learn to, you know, get along with the people around us, but it really starts with learning how to love yourself, accept yourself. And then, you know, the process of allowing life to kind of flow in and help you make any of the adjustments and the changes that you're going to need to make. To kind of, you know, make your life a better place. And any work that you do, really is just, it's not only going to benefit you, it'll benefit your family, it'll benefit your friends. And of course it benefits the world. Every positive act, every positive thought, goes up on the plus side, you know? So, you can build those karma points.
Thank you so much. You know, this has been really lovely to, we are in a way have been celebrating the quiet one, the quiet beetle, right, George?
Yes,
and
yeah.
Closing on a note of quiet, find your quiet to go home, you know, to yourself. And so we will let you go, and we will offer and close here on the broadcast the another George or a tribute to George. Would you like to just introduce this song briefly, and then I'll sign us off?
Great. Thank you. Yeah, actually, the song started as a tribute to George Harrison, primarily in just the chord changes that I used, things that George, I thought that, you know, he would resonate with. And then as I got into the production of the piece, it was also, I started to really feel an appreciation for George Martin, who was their producer. George Martin was the one that brought in the orchestral elements and some of the sounds of the studio that the Beatles were asking for. So the song is called, you know, Sir George, Liverpool Farewell, and it really is an appreciation to both George Martin, their great producer, and of course the late great George Harrison.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Jamil Graham. Thank you to all the listeners for joining us and this birthing of music and the conversation of consciousness. Yay! All right.
Thanks, Jamil. Take care.
You as well. You as well. And now for all the listeners who would like to stand by, we will offer you the Sir George Liverpool farewell. Good night, and I hope you all take good care of yourselves and take good care of each other. Until next time. Bye-bye.